Okay, Mike, I think we are good to go.
All right, fantastic. All right, well, with that, we will call to order the January 27th, 2022 meeting of the Arizona State Board for Private Postsecondary Education at 10:01 a.m. For clarification, the board may go into executive session for the purpose of obtaining legal advice pursuant to ARS 38-431.03A3 on any matter on the agenda. The board reserves the right to change the order of the agenda items with the exception of hearings. Mr. LaMountain, would you please call roll?
I will. Dr. Mittman. Dr. Mittman is absent. Mr. Romano?
Here.
Mr. Romano is present. Mr. Lubke?
Here.
Mr. Lubke is present. Dr. Leck?
Here.
Dr. Leck is present. Mr. Wallace?
Here.
Mr. Wallace is in attendance. Mr. Ball? Mr. Ball, I see you on here. I think you're muted. Doug, if you can hear us, or just wave your hand. I can see that Doug is here, so I'm going to count him as is in attendance, and he can work on the speaker. And then Ms. Cardullo?
Present.
Ms. Cardullo is present. For staff, my name is Kevin LaMountain. I'm the executive director, and I'm present. Mr. Blanchard?
I am present.
Mr. Blanchard is present. Ms. Stanfield?
Present.
Ms. Stanfield is present. Ms. Rome?
Present.
Ms. Rome is present. And the Assistant Attorney General, Seamus Monahan?
Present.
Okay.
Mr. Romano. Thank you, Mr. Romano. Appreciate that. Addressing item number 3 on the agenda, are there any declarations of conflict of interest? Hearing none, we will proceed forward. The audio recording of the December 9, 2021 meeting has been posted on the website. As a reminder, the State Board's policy for the recording of minutes is to audibly record all meetings and post them on the website. Mr. LaMountain, can you confirm that the audio minutes for the December 9th meeting have been posted and are audible?
Mr. Chairman, I can confirm that the meeting minutes are audible and on posted on our website.
Wonderful. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes?
Dick Lubke, so moved.
Scott Wallace, second.
Great. By roll call, Dr. Mittman. Dr. Mittman is absent. Dr. Leck?
Yay.
Dr. Leck votes aye. Mr. Romano?
Aye.
Mr. Romano votes aye. Mr. Lubke?
Aye.
Mr. Lubke votes aye. Mr. Ball? Give us a thumbs up, Mr. Ball. I got a thumbs up, so that's an aye. Mr. Wallace.
Aye.
Mr. Wallace is an aye. Ms. Cardullo.
Aye.
Ms. Cardullo is an aye. By your vote of 6 ayes, 1 absent, that motion passes.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. LaMountain. We can move forward now to the review and discussion of the Executive Director's Report.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Romano, and members of the board. In your packet today, you did receive an updated executive director's report. I'll go through some of the highlights. I do want to apologize for my voice. I've caught my second round of COVID. I'm very excited about it. So we'll see how this is going to pan out. I remember how the first one panned out, and I'm still alive. So that is my goal for the second round of COVID. So.
That's a great goal, Mr. LaMountain. We appreciate that.
So under the information that we have that is provided in front of you, I put down both where we are financially for both PV 2056, which is our operations account, and 3027, which is our student tuition recovery fund. In both those areas, we are tracking to what our appropriation is for the operations budget. It is going to, I think, within a few dollars end up at the end of this fiscal year exactly what we had budgeted, which is still, as a reminder, a bit of a loss over the revenue. We do have a few things that are going on, and something that I'm going to put together and provide to the board for the next meeting under our student tuition recovery fund budget is the potential to request an expenditure of approximately $50,000. Out of that fund, that expenditure would be to provide the first round of funding for what will be a long-term 4 to 5 year program to digitize the nearly 5 million documents that we have stored. So that'll be the first chunk, which will get us, we hope, through at least one institution will be around that 50,000. So again, I don't have everything put together on that. It's not an actionable item at this point in time, but during our February meeting, I will bring that back up to the board.
You have no one really asked me to make me
up now. All right, Mr. Ball, we can hear you now. So
thank you.
Great. Under the school location closures, little has happened since the last conversation that we had in December. The American Institute of Interior Design did close on the 17th of December. That particular institution, we in the staff level have worked closely with a school in Oklahoma to do potential transfers of institution of the individuals, some of the individuals that are willing to continue their education to that institution. We do have the bulk of the transcripts of the students that were currently enrolled at the time of closure. And I believe at this point in time, we have less than half a dozen of student tuition recovery fund requests. I think there's still some determination of what the next step is for a number of these students in terms of the direction that they want to choose to take as they move forward with their education. There's no other additional comments on that. We did pay off the last STRIFE student tuition recovery fund to a student from the university or Southwest University of Visual Arts. That has been paid out to the institute or to the student, and I'm submitted our final bond recovery for that, which was a small amount for $458. On the dashboard, you see we're at 226 schools, down one from the last report. However, we do have two new schools on the agenda today, and we have a number of new schools that are coming forward in the future. We have 18 pending institutions. We're completing our January renewal cycle, which is for the most part will be done after our meeting today. And then you also see under the schools that were in teach out, we don't have any schools that are in teach out at this particular time. And you see the number of service requests. I provided some of that information in your folder as well. And then along with the institutions that are on HCM1, so that we're monitoring those particular institutions as well. I do want to go, we have a US DOE action update, which we will talk about in a few minutes regarding the University of Arizona Global Campus that we'll be doing a question and answer here in a few moments. Under the legislative update, SB 1065, which is our bill that we, which is a bill that would potentially increase our fees moving forward. It passed through both the Senate Education Committee, the Rules Committee. It passed 8-0, and it was a consent item and consent agreed to on rules along with the Senate caucus and the House caucus, both Democrat, the Senate Republican, Senate Democrat caucus. So it is moving forward. In your packet, I also wanted just to direct you to a couple other things that we're watching at the legislation of this year. Which would be SB 1332. If you recall, we had a presentation a few months back by Midwestern University that had concern about a statute that addressed and didn't address private institutions as it relates to a terrorism bill, if a terrible act were to happen on campus. So that bill is SB 1332. It gets its I believe it has just moved through education this week, or is going to move to education next week. And so I just wanted to make you aware of that. And I don't know, is there any additional questions that the board has at this time regarding the either the legislation or the executive director update?
Kevin, you said that there's 18 additional institutions that have applied. Are those coming from any one particular state due to not having SARA, or are they just, you know, grown here?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Dr. Leck. It's really mostly brand new schools, smaller new schools that are interested in starting up. There are a few. I don't believe I've put that list in here, but something I could certainly send out to the board so that you have an idea of who is looking at opening up a new school. Great.
And it's Susan Cardullo, Mr. Romano, Kevin. When you mentioned that the bond was recovered and back to strife on one of the school closures, what percentage of schools have a bond on them right now?
The majority of the schools that are non-accredited programs, all of the non-accredited programs have a bond. That is going to be anywhere between, the majority of them are at 15,000, and they can go up from there. Accredited institutions, unless there's an issue that we see that the board agrees to require a bond, the accredited institutions, the majority of them, do not have a bond at this time.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, hearing no further questions, if Mr. Lamont, you're good, we can move on to agenda item number 6, which is review and discussion of the University of Arizona Global Campus. Would you be kind enough to provide us with a summation?
Certainly. Mr. Romano, members of the board, the Arizona State Board has been in receipt of a number of documents that are in your board folder. Both from the United States Department of Education and from the University of Arizona Global Campus as it relates to issues that the U.S. Department of Education needs clarification on. It brought it to the point where I felt it was important to get to the board so that you understood that there what the issues, again, if we remember, the University of Arizona Global Campus is licensed by our board. It is a unique relationship between the global campus and the Tucson-based physical campus that is the public university. So after reading through the information, I really felt it was appropriate to bring to the board for additional discussion. So before you today, as you can see, I'm not sure who exactly wants to come up first, but you see who is representing the institution.
Sure. If Mr. Lamont, is it appropriate now for me to speak?
Mr. Romano, are you good to move forward?
Yes, absolutely. I was going to ask if the school could just state who is represented today, and then whoever would like to take the lead on just bringing us up to speed.
Sure. I'm Paul Pastorek. I'm the CEO and president of the University of Arizona Global Campus. With me today is our general counsel, Tommy Screen, our two persons who work in connection with your organization with the U.S. Department of Ed, Courtney Lugo von Ops and Stephanie Kauser. We're here today to respond to any questions you have. I'd like to just give you a brief background and offer ourselves for any questions. So as you'll recall, because we've been here before, we were originally approved to operate as we are making our move from the state of California over to the university, over to Arizona. And in fact, we have been operating out of Chandler, Arizona now since about November. We're closing our operations in San Diego as of 4 days from now, January 31. When we originally transacted this acquisition, the University of Arizona had decided it wanted to acquire Ashford University, and it created an entity called the University of Arizona Global Campus, which is a 501c3 not-for-profit company under Arizona law, and we acquired Ashford University in that process. Part of the structure of our corporation was the University of Arizona Foundation. It's a member of the not-for-profit. And at the time, we anticipated that we would satisfy our financial responsibility obligations with the United States Department of Education with what's called a combined financial statement, combining the financial statement of our member, the University of Arizona Foundation, with ours, to demonstrate that we met the United States Department of Education financial responsibility requirements. At the time, back in when the deal was announced in August of 20, and it was closed, and we actually acquired Ashford University December 1 of 2020, we anticipated that that structure would satisfy the Department of Education. As we worked over this past year, 2021, with the Department of Education, they advised us that they would require something different than what we had expected, but within their regulatory purview. When they informed us that they required something different than what we had expected, which was their notification to us in November, I believe it was November 29th, we then had to go back and evaluate how we would frame compliance with financial responsibility. We met all of the requirements. In fact, we're at about the highest standard of financial responsibility, but there became a problem, as a very hyper-technical accounting problem, with how you present this. The information is the same, but accountants differ on how you do this. So the University of Arizona made a decision that rather than try to address this very hyper-technical accounting problem, it would simply sign the TPPPA, our temporary permit, with the United States Department of Education. By signing the TPPPA, that temporary permit, it resolved all of the issues around financial responsibility. So we indicated, they provided us a subsequent letter in December, I believe it was December 20th, where they said you can proceed with simply signing the TPPPA and we will therefore be satisfied. We did do that on January 4th, which was the deadline within which we had to do it, which the University of Arizona had to do it, and that was then satisfied. And in the meantime, we have been exchanging information, which the department has requested us to do, to provide them with certain additional financial information, which we're doing, which we're current with, and everything seems to be moving in the right direction. I would also mention that University of Arizona has, in the original documentation back in December of 2020, it indicated that it would be allowed, and this was part of our agreement between the UAGC and UA, it would be allowed to ultimately acquire UAGC. When this action to sign the temporary permit with the U.S. Department of Education was concluded, the university notified us that it wished to go ahead and begin proceedings to bring us into the University of Arizona. And earlier this week, the University of Arizona announced to its constituency, and we announced to our constituencies, that we will be undertaking a process to bring the University of Arizona Global Campus into the University of Arizona. And I think we supplied your staff with a note to that effect, which we released to all of our stakeholders in the University of Arizona Global Campus, in which President Robbins released over it to his campus. So I think we're now finally in a position where we've satisfied the financial responsibility requirements by the signatory of the University of Arizona, and now we're going to proceed with the process of bringing the University of Arizona into the University, bringing Global Campus into the University of Arizona.
Thank you for that update. We appreciate it. I have a couple questions just for clarity as well, and then I'll turn it over to my fellow board members. In regards to the integration and the letter, I think it's stated that you're thinking right now about a 12-month transition, so possibly by January of 2023, or are you seeing that potentially longer or shorter?
I think that would probably be the earliest. I'm somewhat speculating here, but I think it will be longer than that. But I will tell you that we're committed to proceeding to do this as promptly as we can. But there are many, many issues that we have to work through. It's the desire of President Robbins, and it's my desire to be quick about it. But I think given the number of regulatory matters that have to be addressed and process steps that we have to address, I think it will be a minimum of that. And I would just say, I think part of the very important thing that we need to keep in mind, we have more than 2,000 employees in our university. We have 28,000 students in our university. When you undertake a transaction like this, you need to think through lots and lots of issues so that you do not disrupt the activity. And one thing that we're both committed to is making this a smooth transition. And I think we're interested in maintaining the approach and the process that we've developed for educating online students at the University of Arizona Global Campus.
I'd like to come back around that here shortly, if we could. But I'm also, when I was reviewing the documents, I was trying to understand clarity from the DOE and what was provided to them from a liability standpoint. Can you, if you're able to speak to it, I don't know if you can or not, but can you help clarify? I think there were some legal challenges associated with Ashford before it was converted over. And I don't know if a line was snapped on liability at that time. And then since that time, just trying to get an understanding of where that liability will land and what that looks like.
Sure, I can answer that. There were, at the time of closing, a few lawsuits that had been filed against Zovio and Ashford, our predecessor in interest here. One of those was, as I recall, with the state of Massachusetts. That has since been settled. There's another one that exists with the state of California. And there may be some others, and there may be some other claims as well. All of those lawsuits, and I think one of them, the California one, was referenced in the letter from the department, if I'm not mistaken. In those cases, we are not a party, first and foremost, we're not a party to those lawsuits. In other words, the claims have not been made against the University of Arizona Global Campus. In fact, there was some news release the other day that incorrectly said we are not a party. And they, by the way, that news service has since retracted that. Moreover, as you say, Dr. Romano, a line was snapped as of December 1st, and all of those liabilities which had occurred before December 1st in the nature of these kind of state actions were retained as liabilities by Zovio and Ashford. Moreover, we have an agreement with, which was done at the time, December 1st, with the Zovio, that they will indemnify us in the event we are exposed, but we're not. So for any of those kinds of pre-closing liabilities, they were to indemnify us. So those, I'm sorry, Tommy, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, just one small correction here that I want to clarify. Under Department of Ed regs, if there's any borrower defense claims, they go against the actual university that is in existence. So those borrower defense claims would come against UAGC, but as Paul was just mentioning, Zovio, and through the purchase agreement, would indemnify UAGC against any of those borrower defense claims. Those would be separate and apart from any litigation that's been filed, whether it was in Massachusetts or California or what have you. Sorry, Paul. Just wanted to
No. Thanks for that clarification. Yeah. So basically, the one that the U.S. Department of Education referenced in its letter, we're not liable for that. And even if we were, we would be indemnified. And then there are other kinds of claims which we as a university would have to address, because all universities have to address those. But for any ones which came before December 1st, Zovio would indemnify us for them.
Thank you for that clarification. I'm also trying to appreciate, I guess, you know, the based on when Global Campus was established and the desire of the University of Arizona to integrate it in, how that, and Ms. Lamont, this may be a question for you as well, knowing the intent is there, knowing currently Global Campus is licensed through us, with this integration, do we see that at some point no longer needing to be licensed through us? And is that something that would occur sooner as opposed to later, regardless of the actual integration of Global Campus to that of the University of Arizona prior to 2023?
Mr. Romano and members of the board and Mr. Pastore, I have had a conversation with the Arizona Board of Regents about potential of what that would look like moving forward if the University of Arizona were to be fully consumed by the University of Arizona. There would be very little on our end that we would need to do. They would not need to maintain, if they are no longer a private institution, and that the structure, the way the institution is structured at this particular point now, is no longer valid, and they become a component of the public institution, they do not need our licensure. In terms of notification process, it's as I explained to the executive director for Board of Regents, it's just really a notification on the institution's part, stating when the license would expire and when they would become fully integrated into the University of Arizona. But again, those are conversations. There's no actual documentation in talking about what the structure looks like, at least that I have seen it at this particular point in time. These are just discussions.
Is it really mandated on the actual integration, though, or the actual transfer over of Global Campus to the University of Arizona, I guess? When you merge or you buy a particular school, which we can kind of look at it as that's what's happening here, right? A University of Arizona is essentially saying, we're now going to assume by take advantage of what was in the agreement to absorb Global Campus in. Of course, there's natural, you know, integrating of that business into the current business, but it seems as though that would be more the trigger point to no longer require a licensure through us. But now it falls to that of the University of Arizona. So I guess I'm trying to appreciate if that is the case, you're not really negotiating at this point whether Global Campus is going to be absorbed by the University of Arizona. That seems to be that's a fact that it is going to happen. So I'm just trying to really get clarity of, you know, it seems at this point notification is occurring that, you know, University of Arizona is absorbing Global Campus, and at this point Global Campus now falls under the University of Arizona and that of the Board of Regents. Am I missing something?
Just a point of clarification, Mr. Romano, member of the board, until a notification has happened, so it's not dissimilar from a change of ownership or a change of control that we do at the board level. Once that notification has happened, once the contractual obligation is completed, then it would, as far as the board is concerned, we just need the notification from the institution, along with the documents showing that everything has been completed, and now this institution is no longer considered a private institution, it's considered a public institution. This is something that we have not been down this path before, where we have one foot in public and one foot in a private. And so we're learning, I think, as we go, of what this is ultimately going to look like. But as of today, and until I receive notification from the University of Arizona Global, they are going to continue to be licensed by this board, fall under the jurisdiction of this board, and the rules and the regulations of this board. And it sounds as though that will probably be the case for a year or so.
Mr. Romano, if I could just offer this. I'm not a lawyer in this domain. I'm a lawyer, but I'm not in this domain. But this is one thing I know because of my experience in dealing with the change of control that we had to deal with receiving Ashford into the University of Arizona Global Campus. The change of control is a process which is necessary for us to be brought into the University of Arizona. And I think I know what you're trying to get at, you know, is what point is it that we legally are no longer regulated by your board and we would go under a different regulatory control? I think it would be after the change of control process is completed. That process has many different aspects. And when I said earlier, I thought, you know, this is just my personal opinion, it might take as long as a year to do that. It's because these change of control processes do take a lot of time. And, you know, it's very important to describe in the change of control process how you're actually going to be governed in the future to assure that the integrity of delivering education to students. And I think what the University of Arizona and we have done in our announcement earlier this week is said, we're going to sit down now and begin to plan what the best way to govern this operation will be in order to benefit and serve our students. And then once we decide that, then we go to the change of control process. And then I believe once we go through that and successfully accomplish that, then we would be coming back to your board and indicating that we have now completed that and we'll go through the process of, you know, moving over to some other governance mechanism.
Thank you. That was helpful. I think where I was probably getting caught up was this integration versus change of control. And it sounds like these are the same terms, essentially, in this case. So change of control, you're still anticipating that to occur sometime around January 2023, probably not earlier than that, possibly later than that. And until that happens, Global Campus would still fall under us from that standpoint. So that is helpful from that particular piece. Also, just a point of clarity. Yes, Mr. LaMountain.
Mr. Romano, members of the board, just as a reminder, we do have a bond for the University of Arizona Global Campus of $827,400. So we do have that bond in place as we speak.
All right, I'll open it up to any of the other board members if you have any questions. Yes, Dr. Leck.
I do have a few. Reading through the documentation so that I'm clear, is it that the Department of Ed is taking issue with the previous change of control that occurred, and now you're going to have to go through yet another one, so that's clearing that up in the past? No.
No, ma'am. The change of control that I'm referring to is coming in the future is as a consequence of the University of Arizona signaling that it wishes for us to integrate with it. But the change of control was processed through the WASC, the Western Association of Colleges and Universities. That was completed successfully. Now, there is also, just for clarification, there is also a pending request for approval of us to operate as University of Arizona Global Campus, which is before the U.S. Department of Education. That typically takes around 18 months to process. So that's not hung up. That's not a problem. That's just a part of the step. But no, ma'am, the original change of control approval, which was given, was not the subject of any issue that we had with the Department of Education.
Okay, so the letter that from the Department of Ed was talking about how the University of Arizona is now stepping up and going to be held financially liable, right, for University of Arizona Global Campus. As part of that, that's what's triggering that as part of that, you know, kind of acquisition or integration, if you will, if that's the word you're using.
Yes, that's the word I'm using. The absolute legal consequences of all this are beyond my capacity to advise. But what I would say is this, the main issue, the issue that we were dealing with the Department of Education was the financial satisfying the financial responsibility regulations of the department. That was the main issue. And signing the permit, our permit, that by University of Arizona signing that permit, they basically provide an assurance to the department that they'll stand behind us on our financial obligations.
Okay. So looking at what your path going forward, one of the other questions that it seemed you guys have outstanding was whether or not the Department of Ed would recognize your nonprofit status. So is that going to continue to be something that you have to pursue in the meantime while waiting for the integration into U of A?
Well, I can't explain exactly how that will happen, but to answer your question, in our original application to the department, which we filed back in December of 20, sometime around there, we requested acknowledgement that we're not for profit organization. That is part of the larger approval that is in process with the department, and we expect when they complete their approval of the transition from Ashford to University of Arizona Global Campus, that will be approved. That wasn't involved in any of these conversations that we had over the last several weeks with the department.
Dr. Luck, one thing that I would add there, if you don't mind, Paul, is that the IRS has already granted that not-for-profit status. It's simply the Department of Ed, as part of their consideration, they're still looking at that. And it's you know, our understanding that, in fact, that's still under active consideration.
And the 18-month process that you're talking about is really like another pre-acquisition review for that 18-month process you said department is for the integration? Like, well, you have to wait for something from them to say, yes, go forth?
Well, it's actually a post-acquisition review. There are different kinds of reviews that the department can do, to my understanding. And we chose to do a post-acquisition review, which is why we have to wait the 18 months.
And that clock, Dr. Luck, started on December of 20, right? That 12 to 18-month process started 13 months ago.
Yeah, so you're expecting or hoping to hear sometime mid-year, I'm assuming.
Right.
Yep. So my next few questions have to do with, and it goes back to that integration, and like when you look at the, so some of us sit on the Arizona SARA board, right? And University of Arizona is a participant in SARA on their own, as is U of A Global Campus separately, right? So the question being, and it seems like they have perceived this to be two very different entities, and then you read articles regarding the faculty and their feelings regarding this relationship. When you go through that integration, and I only ask because of accreditation, right? So, you know, you guys don't have U of A doesn't have a site visit until I think 2030 or something, but is that part of that going to be reviewed? How, like, is it going to become one entity, or you guys, do you think it's still going to be two separate entities that are sitting both delivering distance education in different ways? Do you know that yet?
No, we don't. That's going to be part of this discussion.
Interesting.
So.
Okay.
Mr. Lamont.
Mr. Romano and Dr. Lack, just as a point of clarification, the University of Arizona Global Campus is not at this time member of SARA. The University of Arizona Tucson is. Just
you're right. I misspoke.
For clarification.
Also, in the documentation, it talked about the heightened cash monitoring level one. Is that currently in effect for Global Campus, or is that about to take effect?
No, it went into effect several weeks ago. Okay. And once we satisfy the conditions of the letter, and we've been in the process of providing the department with all of those pieces of information it's requested, and once we've satisfied that, then we'll come out of HCM1.
There any concerns in regards to being on that for a sustained period of time and how that may impact your operations?
It's not really an impact on our operations. I mean, the one part of it is we have to report financial information, and the other part of it is we have to wait a little bit longer, before we can draw down funds from the department. But we don't expect that the delay in drawdown, which is not very long at all, will have any material impact on our operations.
Thank you for that. Any other board members have any questions for Global Campus? All right, hearing none. We appreciate your time today in regards to answering our questions, bringing us up to speed on where things currently stand. We'll obviously ask that you continue to work with the staff, Mr. Lamont, and others directly as new information becomes available, and we will continue down that road. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, and I assure you we'll stay in touch with your staff and keep them informed as we make progress in this regard. We appreciate you.
Thank you. Have a wonderful day.
Bye-bye. All right. Thank you. You too.
All right. Well, we will move on to item number 7, which is review, discussion, and possible action to open board complaint.
for New Horizon Phoenix, Mr. Lamont.
Kevin, I apologize. Chair, members of the board, this is Assistant Attorney General Seamus Monahan. This is a little backwards than you normally do the process. This was originally on for review and discussion, but based on the materials, we thought better not hamstring you if you want to take action. So basically what you would be deciding today, this is not an initial review. It's whether you believe that there's enough that the board can start investigating and then kick this to the complaint committee once the investigation is finished.
Thank you for that clarification.
Yes.
Mr. LaMountain, would you like to give us status?
Certainly. Mr. Romano and members of the board, before the board today is an issue that was brought to our attention by the Veterans Arizona Department of Veterans Services in terms of the withdrawal of approval for all programs for New Horizon Learning Center in Phoenix. As a reminder, there are two New Horizon centers in Arizona. One of them is in Tucson. One of them, this one, is in Phoenix, and they are completely separate. And the only thing, the discussion is for this particular location. In your board pack, you received a number of letters that were going back and forth between the Arizona Department of Veterans Services and New Horizons that included up to a suspension that happened late last year, and then a complete withdrawal of the approval for VA funding. Also noted on here is the Arizona Department of Veterans Services withdrawal decision is not appealable. So the decision that you see in your folder and the letters that you do have are final, and the institution relied quite a bit on the funding for the Veterans Services. So there certainly is a financial obligation that is change that has happened to this institution. So I think, and again, representing the institution today is Mr. Zach Hiscock. Mr. Romano.
All right, Mr. Hiscock, thank you very much for joining us. I do see you on the screen now. We'll turn it over to you here in just a second. Just as a reminder, we do have the materials that were provided for this discussion and at least review from that standpoint. So please don't feel as though you have to reiterate all of that. But obviously some very concerning pieces brought forward from the VA, and obviously a very substantial action that they took as a result. Can you just help us appreciate how it got to this point and what the steps forward are that the institution is currently looking at?
Sure. So thank you. Thank you for having me today. So obviously you guys have the withdrawal letter and a lot of the documentation, so I'm not going to go into the, you know, all of the back and forth with the letters and whatnot. I'll speak to the three key areas that were listed in the withdrawal and the reason for the withdrawal, and I'll speak to what we've done since then and, you know, open it up to obviously questions that you guys have there. So there were three areas there, the first of which was a relationship we had with a vendor that provided us leads. We had already terminated the relationship with that vendor as of, I believe the last business we did with them was July of 2021. The withdrawal was several months later, so that relationship had already been terminated. And it was basically we purchased leads from this vendor, for, potential students. And the VA, well, FAA determined that, because we were purchasing leads, we were therefore paying incentive comp based on enrollments, which in my mind is not an accurate, assumption by them. There are many schools that pay for leads, so I don't really understand how that specifically warrants a withdrawal. But this also stemmed from a withdrawal that was made in Missouri, I believe, with another New Horizons who worked with the same vendor. So I'm assuming that went into effect. Again, we've terminated the relationship with that vendor, and we don't use them anymore, so that has already been rectified. If we want to talk about what's gone on in the past, I mean, obviously we can talk about that, but moving forward, we don't use that vendor anymore. The second piece had to do with incentive-based compensation for our educational consultants, which are our admissions folks. They had been on a comp plan that warranted them a salary as well as a bonus based on completion of programs for students, not on enrollment, but on completion. It was actually at the advice of our attorney and based on Department of Education guidelines that we put this program in place. And we have also since as of, you know, new regulations came out with the VA, we have changed that, and all of our educational consultants are now on full salary with no bonus potential. So that has also been rectified. But again, that program was based on previous guidance from our attorney and the Department of Education. And then the last issue with which was listed on the withdrawal letter was a relationship we had with another vendor that was an appointment setting vendor for us and a call center. And it had to do specifically with the script that was being used by that call center to set appointments. I don't know if you guys have access to that or not. I provided it to Mr. LaMountain, and we have since terminated the relationship with that vendor as well. We are currently looking at potentially using another call center, but with a altered script that has been reviewed by our director of compliance. I did hire a director of compliance in August of 2021, and part of that was to move us toward accreditation with ASSET. We attended the conference at the end of 2021, and we are still pursuing accreditation with ASSET. Her name is Donna Sterber-Gamlin. She's got 30 years in education, she's been a great asset for us to try to just tighten up everything as we move toward accreditation. So the last piece I'll speak to just briefly is the financial situation, because I know when I had a conversation with Mr. LaMountain and Mr. Blanchard, they were concerned about that, and certainly the VA was a large portion of our business. But one thing to remember is that New Horizons does business on both the B2B side with companies in the Valley, as well as the B2C side. So where, you know, we've lost a major funding source on the B2C side, we've also looked at some other third-party financing options for our students, and we have beefed up the B2B side of our business. So in terms of financial well-being, we've had a rough couple months, I'm not going to lie, but we're in okay shape. I don't have any plans to go out of business or anything like that. We have cut some staff in the last couple months to obviously accommodate, you know, the difference in funding. And then the last piece is with the student recovery fund. Our programs are very short in nature. So everybody that was part of the VA funding at this point, I believe, has already been taught out. I don't believe there's anybody left in there. If there are, they may have another week or so, but I'm pretty sure that everybody is taught out. And we have no concerns with that. We do have a $15,000 surety bond. We also have the New Horizons Network, and I've already spoken with one of the other owners, actually the one that owns the New Horizons in Tucson. He was interested in acquiring it. He heard what went on. So, you know, if something drastic happens and worse comes to worse, they would acquire and be able to teach out the students. So I don't have any concerns about the student recovery fund. With that being said, I guess I'll open it up for questions. I don't know what other areas you might want me to go into.
Thank you, Mr. Hiscock. I do have a couple just for clarity as well, and I don't profess to understand your business or kind of the layout. It seems as though the central operation is in Pennsylvania, and then here is kind of a part of the school, or is it a franchise?
It's a franchise model. The corporate headquarters is actually in Tampa, Florida now. It moved from Pennsylvania.
Okay. And so you operate a franchise of New Horizons here in the Arizona market with one location, multiple locations?
Just one location.
Just one location. And so can you help me understand? You were just saying if you get into a teach out mode or there might be a company that's interested in purchasing, are you talking about your franchise with New Horizon, or were you talking something different?
No. So the franchise that is located in Tucson, Arizona, also has other locations in Southern California, Nevada, and Utah. It's owned by the Landry Group, and that was the franchisee that I was talking about that was open to acquiring a new location. And he should be in good standing with the state as well as the VA, from what I understand.
Okay. Going back for clarity on the concerns that the VA identified, which will lead us to, I think, our determination of whether we move forward with opening up a potential investigation for complaint. With the information that was provided, specifically with this third party that was providing leads, I'm just trying to get clarity here. It gave some really specific numbers, really, really low numbers of leads. Is it my understanding that those were all the leads that were received, or how were leads qualified, I guess, that you received? Were those leads that resulted in an enrollment, or leads that were still wide open to whether they enroll or not?
No, the leads that came to us still needed to, they still spoke with an educational consultant for our team, who was then went through the process and determined, you know, whether they were a good fit for the program and they could benefit from the program. So it wasn't like they were just handing us an enrollment. The third party vendor had no ability to enroll or guarantee enrollment or anything like that.
So asked slightly differently, did you enroll 100% of the leads that were provided to you by this third party?
No.
Okay.
But yet, it was a very large percentage, for sure. They were very the reason we paid a premium for the leads is because they were excellent leads and they closed at a very high percentage.
Would you be able to share what that percentage was?
I don't have the exact numbers. I just know it was a very high percentage, but I could get it for you. It was probably 90% or better.
Mr. Romano.
Mr. Romano, members of the board, that would be something that we would be requiring and requesting information on moving forward if we open a complaint.
Yeah, just trying to understand that a little bit more. Thank you.
No problem. Yeah, it's just to clarify, it's a different setup than your typical lead generation, where you know you get a massive number of leads and they, you know, you're not paying a premium for them. This organization actually worked with multiple other schools, so they were very good at basically understanding what kind of leads would potentially be good fits for schools.
And then I'm assuming this wasn't exclusive to just potential VA students, but this was any potential student, VA or not. Is that an accurate statement from the third-party lead sourcing?
Correct. Yeah, we had students that used VA funds. We had students that paid out of pocket. We had students that took out loans. It was a mix.
Okay. And these, for example, this lead sourcing provider didn't just exclusively focus on veterans, but any potential students for you?
From my understanding, their focus was veterans.
Okay. And that is that true of the appointment setting group that you leveraged as well?
No, the appointment setting group made appointments for veterans and non-veterans and civilians, both.
Okay. Thank you. I don't have any other questions at this time. Dr. Leck, it looks like you may have a couple.
I do. I think the one thing that I was kind of struck by was in the materials, we had access to the letters from the VA to you outlining what the issues were, and then they gave you a due date. But I don't see anything. It doesn't look like, at least from the materials we have, that you guys responded, which seems to have led to the suspension. But you said you hired a director of compliance. So I'm unclear. Did you respond in between when they gave you notice and they eventually made the decision to suspend, what, in December or something?
So to clarify, there were actually two suspensions, okay? So there was a risk-based audit that was done by the SAA at the beginning of 2021. That audit took a couple months from what I remember, and they did suspend us for that. We responded in time for every, you know, inquiry that was going on there. And then after making corrective actions and changing a couple policies, we were reinstated. The second, we were then audited again by the VA, our ELR, in, I don't know, September, something like that. And it was basically an audit. It was almost the same as our risk-based audit, and they had the same findings. We met every deadline that was put in place. They asked us for financial ledgers for non-supported students, to which myself and Ms. Vigil, Valerie Vigil, who was the person who was conducting it, I was actually at a conference in Vegas at the time, and we couldn't connect. And she never gave a deadline for when she needed that. And then next thing I know, they gave us a suspension. But there was no deadline for that. We gave them all the documents that were needed by every deadline that was imposed on us. So that second suspension to me was pretty unwarranted. But you know, the other thing to make note of is New Horizons as a whole, multiple locations, have had a bit of a target on our back by the VA for years now. And I think it may have something to do with a Department of Justice inquiry that was made with our corporate office, the franchisor, back in March of 2020, which they didn't even tell us about. I had to find out on my own probably about a year later. That had to do with some other locations. So I don't know if they just kind of wanted to, you know, investigate us, and it just seemed like it was a foregone conclusion that we were going to be suspended and ultimately withdrawn, in my opinion. But I mean, I have my attorneys looked at the withdrawal letter, and they still don't understand why there wasn't a cure period that was warranted, because almost every withdrawal letter has a 60-day cure period.
So wouldn't it, if the same issue was found from the first time to the second time, then one is assuming that it wasn't actually alleviated the concerns that they had the first time to have it come up the second time?
Well, not exactly, because they audited the same time period, which was in the past. So if you audit the same time period that was in the past, I can't change what happened in the past, right?
I see.
And it was very odd. I even asked Ms. Vigil, I said, why are we being audited for the same time period? We already got a risk-based audit. And she said, I don't know. She went back and asked her supervisor, and her supervisor said that someone higher up in the VA had said that they had to do an audit.
So one was a risk assessment, and then the other was an actual official audit?
Yeah, and just to clarify, the risk assessment has nothing to do with anything that was done by the school other than just an increase in enrollment. It's a 30% increase in either revenue or enrollments from calendar year to calendar year. Well, from VA academic year to academic year.
And of your B2C business, what percentage does the VA represent, or did the VA represent, if you can share that?
Yeah, it probably represented about 60% or more.
And then, Mr. Lamont, I don't know, it sounds like a suspension took place earlier. I don't know the reporting obligations that may or may not be required here. I'm just trying to understand that. Maybe it doesn't require any type of notification to the board of an earlier suspension. Could you clarify that?
Mr. Romano, members of the board, and any and all communication that happens between an institution and an agency, a governmental agency, should have been reported. I don't recall seeing that particular document. I have had conversations with the state authorizing agency for Arizona, which is in part what brought a lot of this to our attention. So I think through the if you agree to open or make the decision as a board to open a complaint, that is something that we would look at in terms of when we received notification, who notified us, and how that communication happened. And we would provide that to you, obviously, at the if a complaint was opened at the board meeting.
Thank you for that clarification. Dr. Luck.
when you look at the list of the concerns, right, some of them are advertising in a help wanted ad, you know, help wanted section, things like that. Is that what is that your claim of what the lead generator was doing? They were doing that, and that's what got you in, you know, in trouble.
Are you asking me?
Yeah.
No, we weren't posting any ads. We didn't post any ads.
No.
For help wanted or anything like that. I mean, that's a major no-no.
Okay.
Mr. LaMountain.
Mr. Romano, Dr. Leck, that again would also be something through an investigation period that we would be able to provide that information to you. I don't know the answer, and I don't want to speculate.
Understood. That's I think helpful, and I think where we're getting to, we'll probably have a lot more questions here, but ultimately that'll probably lead us to the board making a motion for that. But Ms. Cardullo.
Yeah, that was going to be my response. That's like the third question in a row where we didn't have the information today. We probably need an investigation, so I'd like to make that motion when you're ready.
Ms. Cardullo, you're more than welcome to make a motion at any time.
Okay. I'd like to make a motion to open a board complaint to investigate the possible violations. And do you need me to name the different statutes that were?
No, because this is just a whether to open. It's just, you know, based on the potential violations, the board is just going to start investigating. And then, you know, once it's ready, they'll bring it to the complaint committee, and complaint committee can make their decision like they normally do.
Thank you, Assistant Attorney General, and thank you, Ms. Carrillo, for making the motion. Do I have a second to that motion?
Dick Lubke, second.
Very good.
Great. By roll call vote, Dr. Bittman. Dr. Bittman is absent. Dr. Leck.
Aye.
Dr. Leck votes aye. Mr. Romano.
Aye.
Mr. Romano votes aye. Mr. Lubke.
Aye.
Mr. Lubke votes aye. Mr. Ball.
Aye.
Mr. Ball votes aye. Mr. Wallace?
Aye.
Mr. Wallace votes aye. Ms. Cardullo?
Aye.
Ms. Cardullo? Aye. 6 ayes and 1 absent. That motion passes.
Kevin, I believe Keith has his hand up.
Keith?
Hi, thank you. For the record, if we could put Ms. Cardullo, this is for recruitment practices, not only the statute, but is this based on recruitment practices or advertising, marketing?
Yes, I'll amend my motion.
Well,
I just want clarification, that's all.
I think what I'd like to do too is ask Assistant Attorney General James Monahan if we need to be specific, or if with the documentation that we currently have, if the motion can move forward, because we're going to, I'm unaware of what we will or won't find because we haven't begun the investigation yet. So I certainly wouldn't want to limit it to one specific area, but.
You know, you could amend your motion. Well, you'd rescind your prior motion and then restate your motion to say, you know, open an investigation based on the potential based on the allegations that were contained in the materials the board received today.
Yeah, I would like to do that.
Okay.
So moved.
Thank you.
So I think what I heard was a rescinding of the last motion, which we voted on and approved,
yep,
to a new motion by Ms. Cardullo that would be focused based on the materials the board has received, the board and staff has received, related to the matter for New Horizon.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Great.
Okay. Is there a second?
And can I get a second on that motion?
Dick Lipke, second. Thank you.
All right. Let's rinse and repeat, Mr. LaMountain.
All right. I'm ready to go. Dr. Mittman. Dr. Mittman is absent. Dr. Leck.
Aye.
Dr. Leck votes aye. Mr. Romano.
Aye.
Mr. Romano votes aye. Mr. Lubke.
Aye.
Mr. Lubke votes aye. Mr. Ball.
Aye.
Mr. Ball votes aye. Mr. Wallace.
Aye.
Mr. Wallace votes aye. Ms. Cardullo.
Aye.
Ms. Cardullo votes aye. Once again, by your vote of 6 ayes, 1 absent, the motion passes.
All right. Thank you for that.
Mr. Hiscock, just for clarification, I think we've helped narrow the focus so it's not feeling so maybe overwhelming from that standpoint. We appreciate your time today in answering some of the questions, and the staff will circle back around with you for more information as we look to into this matter further. So we appreciate your time today and more to come.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. All right. With that, we can now move on to our agenda item number 8, which is review, discussion, and possible action on pending license applications. We'll start with the conditional to regular license applications. The first one being up, the Academy of Homeopathy Education. Mr. LaMountain, would you like to provide an update, or would that be Mr. Blanchard at this time?
It would be myself. So in your board packet, you'll have the information is regarding the renewal application for the condition to regular non-accredited vocational license for the Academy of Homeopathy Education. A year ago, they received their initial grant of licensure, and this is their first time up for renewal. And representing the institution is Ms. Carly Auer. Mr. Romano.
Thank you very much. And Dr. Leck, I believe you are the board lead on this. So if you would like to move forward with the school.
Great, thank you very much. Would someone like to make an opening statement for the institution?
Hi, Al, you're here.
just that I'd not been mentioned. So Carly, over to you.
Oh, hello. Yes, I'm Carly Auer. I would actually love for Alistair Gray to make the opening statement. He's here with us. He's the academic director of the Academy.
Yeah, hi there, folks. It's really lovely to be able to speak with you and meet again. So to the board, really appreciate it. AHE, the Academy of Homeopathy Education, is a passionate, very small institution, unlike having 28,000 students or 30,000 students, as we heard earlier in the meeting today. We have 162 students that we are guiding through the process of learning the discipline of homeopathy. Homeopathy has been around for 200 years, and homeopathy education since 1833 in the state of Pennsylvania. But we're licensed in Arizona, and we're committed and passionate to our work, and would welcome any questions that you have about the year that we've had since we met last year.
Well, great. Thank you for that. I have to tell you that I've learned a lot about your institution through your very voluminous catalog. 93 pages for one program. So I might have, some feedback about that just to, on the professional side, a lot of philosophies in there, kind of the stuff that the students need to know is a little bit buried, and a lot of duplication, I would say, just as a general feedback for you on it, because I was trying to, specifically learn how your program works. So some of the, I'll just go through my list, and then I'll open it up to my fellow board members. But on page 4, like in your catalog, you have a map, and it looks like you call them offices, right? And you have them all over the United States, and I believe Australia. And so I'm assuming if those are your offices, is that like physical presence in that state, so you're registered in those states as well? Or they're offices because you have staff that are there that are telecommuting, if you will?
If you'd like me to answer each individual question, then it's definitely the second option that you gave there. These are not physical presences. These are skilled people that we in our small community love to work with, and they're peppered all over the country. So, yes.
Got it. And so I'm not even sure of the requirements, because this is a certificate. Do you have to go to each state that you have students in to get their authorization to offer the program online?
I don't actually know the question. I mean, it's a simple no from my point of view, but Carly?
Sure. This is a really great area for our community and all homeopathy schools. We are aware of SARA. We are not eligible for SARA because our accreditor is not recognized by the Department of Education and we are not degree granting. So there are about 5 other homeopathy schools in the country that all offer distance education. None of them are obtaining state authorization because it is really cost prohibitive and a financial strain on the institution. So our accreditor does not currently require it. And I understand that this board doesn't really recognize our accreditor because it's a private accreditor that's not recognized by the Department of Education. But we certainly recognize our accreditor, and it's just not something that any homeopathy school is doing right now. And we understand that we're kind of operating in a gray area. We would like to be able to obtain that authorization, but we've looked into it, and it's just not something that is possible for us right now.
So, Kevin, I just, I don't know. I mean, you really need to look at each state that you have students in, because it's not really a choice if it's the law, Kevin.
Sure.
Correct. So,
sure, we understand. That.
Just to answer that, the question that I know that the path that you're going down, Dr. Leck. So, Mr. Romano, Dr. Leck, that would be a concern for us if you are offering the education. And I think we had this conversation a year ago, but I'm a little rusty and not feeling great, so I've got to kind of dust some of the rust off of my brain, but you have to follow the rules of every state. Every state is different. And because you are not a member and do not qualify for a member of SARA, there is no blanket authorization in all 50 states. So given that, the challenge that you're going to have is if a state, Wyoming, Idaho, whatever state is out there, if they know that you are operating and offering a program in their state based upon what their state laws are, you may be and potentially would be violating the law in that state, which would then come back to us because we're your home state, and would then be an issue that we would have bring you in front of the board to have an issue of that we have a complaint from a different state that you're in violation of that state policy, which you cannot be. So sure. I know it's expensive. I've got other schools that know it's expensive too, but they don't recruit in states that they're not licensed in. So that would be, from a state board perspective, a concern, a big concern.
Understood. Just a note, and I'm not sure if this is relevant to you all or not, but I would point out the inequity of the situation in that there is another homeopathy school operating in Arizona that currently is not even apparently being required to be licensed by this board. They are also not obtaining state authorization from all the other states that their students are in. So while we do understand this is a federal requirement, I will just note that it is incredibly inequitable for our situation in the homeopathy community, and in particular compared with other homeopathy schools, especially the one that is also in Arizona.
Mr. Romano, Dr. Leck, and members of the board. That first of all, if there's another institution that is out there that is operating that is and that we are unaware of, that would be an opportunity for you to provide that information. We go through and make sure that that particular institution is aligned with the state's regulations, rules, and statutes. So that would be something that you could provide to me or to Mr. Blanchard at any time, and we will begin that process of doing the investigation. Because you have an issue with the statute and the rules doesn't make the statute and the rule different, and we can't change them. So it really doesn't matter what your philosophy is on that. You have to follow what each rule in every statute in every state that you recruit a student in
and or you will be in violation and potentially would have an impact on your license here in the state of Arizona.
And for clarity from what Mr. LaMountain shared, that you can obviously make the determination on where you recruit students from and what states make the best sense for you. As we know, we have other institutions that do not go through the process at all states because of low interest or whatever that looks like. Obviously, you can make that decision that best makes sense for you. And then from that, you know, again, if the board is notified of that, then the board would investigate from that standpoint. I'll leave it at that. Ms. Cardullo, you had your hand up. You are on mute, Ms. Cardullo.
I pushed the raise hand button instead of the mute button. Sorry. my comments were along the same lines as what Mr. LaMountain and you, Mr. Romano, just said, in that it is possible to be in other states and not technically be operating by their state definition. You may not be triggering a presence. And so it is not necessarily costly or even time consuming. It's just a matter of checking state by state. And if you are seeing people doing that in other states, there could be a reason that it's not triggering a presence. If you know someone is physically present, then for sure, there are some regulations they need to be authorized by. That was, and none of that has anything to do with Sarah. Sarah is just a really great convenience for people who qualify that they can have some reciprocity.
Sure. Understood.
So before that, you know, those of us that have operated online programs that are online went state by state by state by state by state. So I guess I'm going to have to ask this is, I think we need a list of where your students are and what state and some kind of research, you know, to figure out whether or not you're in compliance, because it will come back on us in Arizona as the home state. So we'll leave that matter maybe for a little noodling, Kevin and Mr. Romano. Some of the other things that I came across, and I just wanted to, I'm really trying to understand your model because it's just different than, you know, than what I'm used to. So it was a good learning experience. Your programs are 100% online?
Yes.
There's no other way to take those anymore because you guys changed your previous modality from face-to-face to just 100% online. And so in your catalog, there's a section that just says how we support our students. And was interesting because I've kept trying to understand and follow along. And there's a part that says, if choosing to study any subject online, an online engagement specialist as well. But it's not, there is no other choice, right? It is all online. So I think this goes to my earlier point where you guys might want to just go back and read all your material and try and make it, you know, more concise and maybe update it. And because this is what I'm trying to point out is that you can change something in one place, and if it's duplicative throughout the document and repetitive, you're not necessarily going to see it in other places, and that gets you into some other issues.
In this instance, that's exactly what it is. It's a shadow from a previous draft that we've not.
Yeah. Okay. So I think I've started to be able to piece some parts together, but I'm still unclear as far as, you know, I went into your calendar and it had, you know, dates of classes, and then it had times that you had to be online. And now I understand you're using Zoom as far as the modality for students. So it's synchronous where they go to class, you know, 2 days a week. But then it also talks about semesters and your learning. It looks like to me it's a list of topics, right? I can't tell how long the classes are. I don't see that you're actually operating within a semester because the dates just continuously go. So it looks more like continuous enrollment versus a semester. So can you help me understand how you guys work?
For sure. And apologies, because I think there may be a cultural translation. I've worked in the tertiary sector in New Zealand. With the NZQA, in Australia with TAXA, ASQA, in the UK, and now in the state of Arizona. And so the prospectus or the catalog means something different in those different places. And for me, actually, to answer your question would have meant another 50 pages to the catalog. But we actually operate a conventional university semester-based program. There are four semesters. That's it. Within those semesters, there are different subjects. And within those subjects, there are topics. The timetabling is the list of topics that perhaps you've seen. And what you've not seen, I don't think, would have been the subjects. So, for example, in the first semester, there will be a subject, context and the breadth of integrative healthcare. That will be a subject. There will be 8 topics that will be delivered synchronously to the full-time students, asynchronously to the part-time students, and those are timetabled. And so that's the reason you'll see a timetable with a list of topics. If you've actually been to, have you actually seen the timetable? Because the timetable is.
Yeah, I went to the internet site where it had the list of dates on the left, and then it had, 3 to 6 Eastern time on the right, and then it just listed almost like the same. It was like the same, class where it would be like clinical, blah, blah, and then an orientation would be in there kind of thing.
Yeah, no. What you don't see is the fact that we've got a elaborate timetable, which then says in this time slot that you've turned up for, you are now in Materia Medica 101. You're now in Therapeutics 202. And we've had this feedback before, and I appreciate it very much. Inside it seems intuitive, and I appreciate that it may not be, but it's a conventional. It's absolutely. I don't think it exists in any other training in this area, even in some naturopathic training. But it's absolutely a conventional university set up with subjects, topics, and then they are timetabled. Yeah.
So maybe for an outsider trying to read it, again, I'll just recommend that you kind of go back and try and put, or get even an outsider to work with you to say, I don't understand this, because that's exactly what was going on. I'm like trying to put together the pieces for you, but that's just a, professional suggestion.
Sure. No, I really appreciate it. Each of those subjects has a course outline, which, says these are in this course, you're going to learn, these are the learning outcomes. This is the reason for the rationale for the subject. These are the topics. This is the book list. These are the assignments. And these are timetabled in a separate document.
Okay. What platform do you use for LMS? I know you're using Zoom for the classes,
No, we use Moodle. The latest version of Moodle.
Okay. Mm. So the next part I was trying to understand, so I'm used to operating large-scale programs that have licensure certification within them and have clinical. And so, there you have to put in all these operations to actually do the clinical. But when I was reading your documentation, it almost appeared that the clinical is run by student. Like it says, it's student-led, and it was like senior student, kind of runs the clinicals, and like they're going to a virtual class during clinicals and not physically going somewhere to do clinical.
No, let me explain. Our clinical training is very specific, and again, I appreciate that it may not come off from our languaging around it. I think Carly and myself and Denise, the president of the school, have had a number of cracks at this. So. Our accrediting body, ACHINA, determines that students need to have, in the same way, it's exactly the same as medical training. They need to be able to identify, see what's going on. Then they need to be able to integrate it into their growing practice and then apply. And they need to be able to be seen to be having levels of Carly, what's the word? Seriousness. It's not the word I need, but what's a better way of describing it?
Increasing levels of client care and responsibility.
Complexity. Thank you. English. What a student does initially in clinical training is turn up to a clinical training day that you will have seen on the website. It's offered between 3 and 6 on a Monday. And they observe. There's also activities. And then eventually, the level of complexity, the level of work and activities they are required to do is exponential. At some point, once a certain threshold is passed and there's various assessments and hurdles, then they're invited for supervision, supervised practice. They undergo, again, graded activities of identification of they take cases, evaluate those cases under strict supervision 100% of the time, and then they're invited back into that clinical setting for their final 150, 200 hours to also demonstrate in front of myself, other clinical supervisors, their skills. Carly, have I described that?
Yeah, I think Dr. Leck might have been asking also if students show up in person to clinic. All of our clinical training is done virtually through Zoom, just like our teaching is done. Homeopathy, interestingly, is moving more and more virtual. Practitioners are treating people all over the world through video conferencing. So that's the way we teach, and that's the way we can provide our clinical training to all of our distance students, because they're all distant, if that was part of your question.
If I could just follow up on that, it's unique within complementary medicine family because it's an ingestive therapy and a talking therapy. So physical examination is not required nor useful. And so it's actually lends itself beautifully to an online environment.
Well, I don't think it's much different than, based on what you're describing, than, say, pre-licensure nursing, right? You have the didactic part, but the lab, I would associate what you guys are calling clinical more to almost a lab sim kind of, you know, situation versus clinical, where they go out and do it in, you know, so you have that component where what I'm hearing is you have that clinical component where they're doing it supervised via Zoom, right? But when they go back into the classroom, if you will, in that almost like a lab setting. So I think that you guys are using the word clinical in several ways that I just wasn't catching, because I'm used to different words meaning different things. So, okay.
Really, really appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, this is, I went through a ringer. Kevin, I've learned a lot. Thanks, Kevin. okay. So some of the questions I have also, your accreditor requires assessment. Assessment reporting back, I'm assuming, right? And so I'm assuming also one of the things that they're using is that certification exam. So you guys prep them, and because you're part of this, they can sit for that certification. So number one, I was curious, what does that certification even do? And number two, are you required to report like first time pass rates or anything like that publicly, or are you, you know, to your accreditor? Like, what does that certification do?
Yeah, we've been around 200 years and we're still considered an emerging profession, and it's a very deeply unsatisfying situation from that point of view. We are non-licensed integrative healthcare providers. That's the product. That's what we deliver. And as Carly's mentioned, and as you know, the USED does not, at this point, recognize ACHINA, the accrediting body. ACHINA is, I'm a past president of ACHINA, and ACHINA has part of its strategic plan to get USED recognition. In 2017, when we reached out to them, and you can imagine that the USED is in, well, I don't know, various states of seeming chaos. During that time, we went a year without any phone calls being returned. You know, the ACHINA accreditation side and its relationship with the USED is progressing. But that leaves us in a situation where the passionate profession of homeopathy has to regulate itself. And it does it, and it's done it through establishment of the pillars that you would see in nursing or midwifery or in physiotherapy. So that's a certification body that certifies our students, and an accrediting body that accredits the schools. And once a student is accredited from that body, then they can go and pass the exam. But there's no requirement. And so it means that there are people within our community, and this is, I mean, you know, we're on a different topic now, but there are people in our community, unlicensed medical providers, that say, well, we don't want to do your exam, so we're not going to. And then we'll just go about our business and keep their head under the radar. And as Carly said, to a great extent in our profession, that it's almost in a postmodern way gone online, and not for a good reason. And so we are, those of us that are in leadership positions within homeopathy are struggling to create the structures required that would be seen to be required in a respectable licensed healthcare provision scenario, and there are cracks.
They don't have to take the certification. States don't require it. It's a nice to have at this point, and I don't mean anything by that, but it's just a nice to have. You can put the certification in your signature block, but it doesn't actually, it's not required to do it.
It is not required.
No. Absolutely. And every state has different rules and regulations around homeopathy practice. Most states don't name it at all. They don't even recognize that homeopathy is a profession. I don't know of any state that recognizes the national certification. But, you know, as a self-regulatory community and profession, we try to put as much value into that national board certification as we can. We encourage our students to take it. It helps us to legitimize the profession, and the certification doesn't legally mean anything, but homeopathy is a world of buyer beware, and so there are a lot of homeopaths out there practicing all kinds of crazy things that we don't support. And so having that certification tells somebody that, yes, I have been properly trained. I have taken the 1,000 hours required for the certification. I have passed an exam. I do know what I'm doing. And that's where the value is.
Okay. So let's stay with the accreditor right now. So I found it interesting, and I think you're maybe helping me connect some pieces, because this is what I suspected, but that the accreditor requires you to have an admissions requirement of, 60 credit hours in, post-secondary ed from an accredited institution that is recognized, that the accreditor is recognized by the Department of Ed, and yet this one is not.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that somewhat interesting. And then it led me to another section in your catalog where you have in there, and it's a section about, federal funding, and it says something like you don't have it, but that you're looking into it in the future. And I'm not sure. I think I'm going to guess what Kevin would say, because this is my gut reaction, was I would never say that you are looking into the federal funding, because what's going to happen is if you have a student who enrolls into the institution with that in the catalog, and then you never get federal funding because your accreditor never gets recognized by the Department of Ed, you can run into some pickles.
If I could just speak to that really quickly, because I think really that statement, and it, from our point of view, it's not a biggie. We can remove it in our next review very swiftly. But it's a nod to the fact that ACHINA cannot get accreditation with the USED unless one provider is willing to go through the process of federal funding. None of the other schools within the profession of homeopathy are in any way as organized, conscious, basically professional as we are. If it's going to happen, it's got to be this school. And that's the reason why that sentence is in there. If it's going to create a problem, we're probably going to hear from Kevin that it's a problem. We'll remove it. But it was there for a different reason. Do you understand what I was saying?
I hear what you're saying. I don't.
Requirement of ACHINA getting its validation through the USED.
Mr. LaMountain, you had something.
Certainly, Mr. Romano, Dr. Leck. yes, we would have a concern. ACHINA is not recognized by, and I don't want to put this in a bad, by nobody,
right? And by nobody, I mean, we don't recognize it. It's not recognized by the United States Department of Education. It isn't a fundamental component of any type of an accreditation, any type of a certificate, whether it's voluntary or not. I haven't done that much digging into what a CHEETAH is. I know what it's not. And that then becomes a concern for the board, for you, is to advertise that you're seeking this, but I don't know what that means. Again, you potentially would be creating some false promises to students that may think that down the road they may be eligible for funding. I think we all know how long it takes just to get accredited, let alone to get an accreditor accredited by the Department of Education. That doesn't happen often, and it's not easy. There are other accrediting agencies out there that may take a program. There's an accreditor out there that does accredit institutions that also have homeopathy programs. That's up to you to choose and to select if that's a direction that you want to go. That's a quicker path than to get an accrediting agency accredited by the Department of Ed. But that was just a point of clarity, so thank you.
Appreciate it, and we'll attend to that immediately.
Thank you, Ms. Wilmong.
Thank you. I just had one other thing, and again, this goes back to your cleanup, but on page 93, you have like payment options, and it'll say like option A, option B, option C. And so it made me chuckle. Option A and option B under full time are the exact same words. I'm like, I'm looking for punctuation different. I'm looking for something that's different in them. They're exact same. So A and B are one, and then there's a C. And it's the same way under full time as it is part time. So, just another example.
And it's a great example. If you refer to the enrollment agreement, you specify credit card versus check, but in your catalog, you did not carry that same language over. So it looks identical in the catalog on page 93, but on the EA, it specifies a higher fee for credit card with the 4%.
That is just an oversight. We had where it says two annual installments and then two annual installments. There used to be more specific information under each of those options. That was removed without noticing that what was left was redundant. So,
no worries. I think this is just proof to Mr. Lamont that we actually read the materials.
Can I say that to the board, I'm stunned at the level of question. No one has ever asked questions at this granular detail, and it's actually really appreciated. Dr. Leck in particular, thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Leck, if you are concluded, I have a couple questions.
Yes, sir.
So I'm just trying to appreciate this from the full-time and part-time and how that plays into the withdrawals and the LOAs of the students. So currently, understandably, a withdrawal for a full-time student would occur 30 days, with no attendance, essentially. For a part-time, it's 3 months. And then what really kind of threw me off was on the LOA side, and this may be acceptable, I'm just not familiar with it, so I wanted to try and understand it from your perspective. For the full-time program, a student can have up to 2 years of an LOA, and for a part-time student, they can have up to 4 years on an LOA. And I guess I'm just trying to appreciate that of, in a 4 years on an LOA and then trying to come back and try and continue education and how that may or may not. What's the thought around that?
Yeah, look, it's a great question. I didn't really introduce myself. My PhD is in public health and complementary medicine education. And one of the things that's really clear about this particular corner, very strange corner of medical education or education, is that complementary medicine schools have got uncommon demographics. We are right in the middle of the non-traditional student. That's our demographic. It means that overwhelmingly our students are women between, say, the ages of, on average, the bell-shaped curve would be between 35 and 55. And immediately that takes you away from the normal a tertiary environment, undergraduate tertiary environment, where obviously everyone's 19, 18, whatever. In addition to that, they're digitally compromised. In fact, there's strong evidence that people come to our program because of strong philosophical and ideological reasons about technology. They are looking around at the world and the way that medicine is, perhaps conventional medicine, and saying, I want to explore something else. Ironically, we teach fully online. But the demographic is significantly different. Then on the one hand, we've got the state of Arizona and their regulations, but we do actually give a nod to Acina and their regulations and the regulations that are agreed upon in our particular field. And so we've just struck a balance. So when it comes to leave of absence and when it comes to withdrawals, we've given, we've made the calls that we've made. Specifically with the withdrawals, the full-time program, we actually demand attendance, and we're really strict about it. We know that we have much better engagement when folks are turning up, even though they do sometimes have the possibility of catching up asynchronously. But no, a 30-day period of non-contact, and then a three-month period for the part-time students is, again, the way we've landed. Again, we'll take your advice, and if it doesn't make sense, we can, review it and apply it. The part-time program is the full-time program slowed down, and the part-time program is attended and consumed synchronously and asynchronously as well. So that's the other, nuance to the way that we've created our educational model. The last thing I'd say is that we've also got to take into account the demographic is, we have mums, we've got so many babies in our program, it's astonishing. And so we've also factored in time with our demographic to have the first, the second, the third, the fourth kid, and sometimes that means a leave of absence somewhat longer than you might see elsewhere.
I appreciate that. No advice or guidance or requirement. I was just trying to understand better from that standpoint.
Sorry, I was defensive.
No, that's okay. I appreciate you taking the time to help me understand that. The only other piece I would provide guidance on, which I'm sure the board staff probably did as well, is where you can, and things like the grievance policy, you may consider adding language like delegate on that versus one person in particular. You, Mr. Gray, may want to go out on vacation at various times and may be out of pocket. And so it's good to have an alternative there. So just those types of things to keep in mind as well. But I will turn it over to the rest of the board if they have any other questions. Mr. LaMountain, did you raise your hand or were you taking your hand down?
I'm going to raise my hand in a moment, but I'll certainly open it up to the board members.
Okay. Hearing no other questions, I'll turn it over to you, Mr. LaMountain.
Mr. Romano, members of the board, thank you. Given the what we've learned today, I know the recommendation that was in the staff recommendation to the board. I think that there's an opportunity to potentially modify that. Again, I don't want to put words in your mouth. It's your motion. It's your directive. But I don't know at this particular point in time that we've learned that potentially, we don't know yes or no, but potentially the institution is operating illegally in other states. That would be a huge concern for me, for us, for the board, and for you. Secondly, because they're an Arizona institution, the current bonding that the institution has in front of us is, I believe, $15,000. Where in fact their gross tuition revenue this year is $441,304. So there'd be a potential that if the board chose to also, in addition to not granting a regular license, but continuing a conditional license for another year, would also be the opportunity to increase the bond from the current 15,000 that would be more in line with the 10% requirement for the institution, which would be, and then in that case, $44,130. Those would be recommendations, but again, these are your motions and your direction to us.
You know, I want to be cautious here, as I'll interject just briefly. You know, obviously, a school that schools are required, if they operate and have a physical presence in Arizona at this level, would obviously seek that licensure and are required to. While at the same time, I'm concerned we don't overextend by requesting, I guess, materials that or expectations of proof of which states they're being operated in and adhering to versus taking the action that the expectation is that this educational institution is operating at the expectations of a state's requirements. It's incumbent upon them to do so. And if we are notified by that, by a state, that that particular school is operating in contrast to that, then we would take the appropriate action. So I just, this is a fine line here that I want to make sure we don't unduly put an expectation on this institution that we would not otherwise put on other institutions. So Mr. Lamont, I don't know if that, if you have any thought around that, or if that's something the Assistant Attorney General needs to weigh in on.
Mr. Romano, members of the board, I certainly understand that. We do have another institution that has had some opportunities with being licensed in other states in terms of their ceremony participation, which has not been at this point in time concluded, but that institution is sending a tremendous amount of time and a tremendous amount of money becoming compliant with each state regulatory. We did ask that particular institution for a list of states that they were currently licensed in and a list of students that were in states that may or may not be licensed by that particular state. So in this particular case, what I don't know is I don't know what I don't know. And that does somewhat concern me. But again, it goes back to the direction from the board, and perhaps Mr. Monahan could add some clarity as well.
With Kevin, I mean, I brought it up because of that. Like, that is an expectation. If it's going to come back on Arizona, that's what I was caring about. Not to mention that we have had these conversations with every institution I think that I've ever seen that I understand that, you know, figure that part out. So.
I hear you, and this is good discussion, and I will just offer that the action we're taking with that particular group is a result of the notification that they had fallen out of compliance. So we were notified of an action that took place that required us to dig in deeper versus us going to that institution and originally saying, give us a list of all the states you're going to operate in and then give us the information necessary to demonstrate that you are approved to operate in all of those states. So I do see a difference here. Assistant Attorney General Monahan, if you are on, any guidance you could provide on this?
Thank you, Board Chair, members of the board. You know, this really is just up to you guys. It's within your panoply of choices that you can make when renewing a license. You know, how you feel about requesting materials that, you know, you're not sure if there's been some kind of violation. Again, that's up to you whether you think that's appropriate. Mr. Gray could, shed some light on that issue for you, maybe answer some of your questions about that. But no, I don't think this is a legal question. I think it's more of a policy question based on what you want to do going forward.
Thank you for that. Mr. Gray, you did maybe have additional information you'd like to provide. So,
I raised my hand, not my virtual hand. But I very much appreciate the conversation. It's come as a surprise it's not come as a surprise. It's come as a surprise from a different perspective. As you can tell, hopefully by Carly and myself, we are completely transparent with you, and we're in a gray area. I can provide you by the end of the day, Mr. LaMountain, the list of our students and the states they're in. I can also, by perhaps the end of the week or next week, have a plan for you on the way in which we would proceed in going about researching the requirements of each of those states and what would be required of us. I would also actually request that you seem to have information about other avenues. And I've worked on both sides of the fence in institutions, but also as a regulator. And I'd much prefer to work, you know, with you on this to ensure it, so that you're confident about our compliance. I mean, for me, that's how I would prefer to proceed. And so we'll give you anything you want in terms of information to make you confident about compliance. And further than that, Carly, this is something more strategic. We obviously need to begin a conversation around seeking leads in obvious places and not in some other places.
Ms. Cardullo, you had your hand up prior.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Gray, for that offer. But hearing Assistant Attorney General's counsel, I agree with Mr. Romano that if and when we ever hear from another state, it'll be cause for an immediate, you know, complaint investigation. But the previous one that I remember was because a state told us that there was a problem. This is a new school to Arizona. They're trying to follow the rules of Arizona. I can tell that they're not going to have to go before a board like this for every other state. Some states, yes, if they want it. But some states will be a phone call or an email, and they'll say, well, that doesn't trigger a presence. So I actually would be comfortable still, voting on an approval and then just concerning ourselves with not overreaching outside of Arizona.
Dr. Leck, you had your hand up. Dr. Leck, you are on mute.
Thank you. I was trying to contemplate this in particular, and I think that, and I'm going to say that I think the difference for me is that, you know, a lot of us who work at institutions that have Title IV are under the requirement by the Department of Ed to make sure that you are following the rules as far as state auth of operating in a state. So there are entities that are looking at ensuring that, right? The Department of Ed does that. The accreditor does that. And so in the case of institutions that don't have those types of bodies, there is no one else. And I only get concerned that, if it's going to be found, does that damage our reputation, with another state because they have to be the ones to tell us that someone's doing it? And I mean, I guess I've just been doing this for so long. I would think that everyone has to comply with this, you know, every state that they're operating in, but that's the last word I'll say about it.
Well, certainly our expectation is that all of our schools are complying appropriately at all times, and if not, so that they either self-disclose or made aware by, whether it's through our state entity or other states. And then obviously our schools understand that, you know, based on other states making us aware of a situation has different weights and consequences associated to it than that of self-disclosure by that institution. While at the same time, as we're talking this through, I think we're trying to strike a balance. Assistant Attorney General has given us guidance that it's with our right to request or not based on this. And so if there are no other questions from our board members, so I will pause just momentarily. Are there any other questions from our board members? Hearing none, Dr. Leck, you being the lead, would you like to make a motion for the school?
Make a motion that you guys will like, or make the motion I want to?
It is your motion, Dr. Leck. We want you to feel comfortable with making a motion. We may give guidance to amend, while at the same time, that is your opportunity as a board member.
Okay, so I would like to make a motion that we approve the conditional to regular non-accredited vocational license with an increase of the bond to $44,000 and however many exact, as well as a commitment by the institution that they review all states that they have students in within the next month and determine whether or not they are deficient in seeking any other state's authorization. Compromise?
Mr. LaMountain?
Mr. Romano, member of the board, just to clarify, the if we were to do the, you can do whatever bond increase you want. It can be 44,000, but the calculation would be $41,304.
41,000, how much?
304.
Amending to my motion with 41,304 for the surety bond.
Do I have a second to that motion?
I'll second it.
Mr. Ball has seconded that.
Okay, by is there a?
There's still discussion, so we can take discussion. Ms. Cardullo?
Yes, since I took exception with Dr. Leck, I thought I should clarify, now that you called it a commitment, I think that's great, versus directing staff to investigate it. If you just say, hey, because all schools should have a commitment to comply with the rules, right? So I approve that. Thank you.
She did find that right compromise, didn't she?
I wanted to make sure she knew that, yes. So, and I didn't want the other board members to.
Threaded the needle very nicely.
Thank you.
Mr. LaMountain, would you take roll?
Certainly. Dr. Mittman. Dr. Mittman is absent. Dr. Leck?
Dr. Leck?
Aye.
Dr. Leck votes aye. Mr. Romano?
Aye.
Mr. Romano votes aye. Mr. Lubke?
Aye.
Mr. Lubke votes aye. Mr. Ball?
Aye.
Mr. Ball votes aye. Mr. Wallace?
Aye.
Mr. Wallace votes aye. Ms. Cardullo?
Aye.
Ms. Cardullo votes aye. By your vote of 6 ayes, 1 absent, the motion passes.
Congratulations. With that, we thank you for your time. Please do understand that we're asking you to look into that. And as we stated before, the expectation is that the schools are always operating in compliance. That is your responsibility. If you need assistance and guidance around that, the State Board is a resource from that as well, so please do not hesitate to reach out if we can offer additional assistance.
Thank you very much. Thank you to each board member for all of your feedback and for this very helpful discussion. We appreciate your time.
Really, really, totally appreciate it, and thank you for the granular details. Really good.
Thank you. Thanks. All right. We will move on to Inspection Go Academy. For conditional to regular. Mr. LaMountain, would you please give us a brief description?
Mr. Romano, members of the board. Before the board today is the renewal application for conditional to regular non-accredited vocational license for Inspection Go Academy. Again, the institution was licensed last year at a meeting. And representing the institution is Mr. Noah Wallstrom. Mr. Romano.
Mr. Ball, you are the lead on this, so if you would like to take it from here.
Sure. Good afternoon, Mr. Bolton.
Hi, Mr. Ball. Good afternoon.
Could you sort of bring us up to date on the status of the school?
Sure. So just by way of background, my name is Noah Wallstrom, and I'm the compliance administrator and legal counsel for Inspection Go. We have many services that cater to the home inspection profession, And as a part of that, we have an education division for pre-licensing education. It's rapidly growing. Since the last time I spoke with you all last year, we were licensed in one state and operating in one state, and now we're operating in almost 20 states. So we're very excited about that. Within the past year, we've had a handful of students, a small handful of students, but we are poised to grow, and we expect many more students moving forward. And that's all I have for the time being. I guess I would open it up to any questions that you might have.
Could you explain how the location there in Gilbert fits into the overall picture of the school?
Yes. So whenever we first applied, I'll explain that our home inspection curriculum was first developed to be in person. And whenever we applied, the location in Gilbert, Arizona, served as our in-person location. And that location was visited, I think, by Mr. LaMountain. And it is a home inspection company that has partnered with us, and they're fully capable of providing in-person classes. But since the advent of COVID, we've moved towards Zoom classes and are starting to push more towards a self-guided model.
Are you, you're not a franchise here in Arizona of the national, right? You're just a division,
right?
Or a...
So we have, our home state is your state, where we're actually headquartered in Pennsylvania. So I guess you could describe us as a franchise model, where we operate schools in several states across the United States. But again, we're headquartered in Pennsylvania, and your state has served as our home state.
So one of the things I noticed, looking at your financial statements, you have a huge deficit. You've spent $1 million on software development. And so I'm sort of concerned about your viability. You borrowed a lot of money to keep going. So what is the plan there to get yourself out of the hole?
Right. So as far as I'm aware, we have a pretty robust products and software division of our company. We provide software for home inspection reporting. So a lot of funds was pumped into that. Within the past year, we're also management consulting for home inspection companies. And with that, we have also a very robust call center, and we've hired many employees to work in our call center, which has increased our expenses as far as payroll goes. So I would say that our focus and our funding was allocated a little bit more towards products and our software within the past year. But I will say that we've had numerous investors and capital opportunities come about. We're very excited about it. That coupled with the growth that we've had with our academy, I think we're poised to grow and become a lot more profitable than we've shown.
Do you produce financial statements just for the Arizona part of the operation?
I believe I did, yes.
I don't think I have any of that in my packet, so...
Mr. LaMountain, or Mr. Blanchard has his hand up. Mr. Blanchard, would you like to maybe add color on that, or was it related to something else?
Yeah, Mr. Ball, members of the board, and I hope this, as you went through the application, BTR requires graduates from programs to get licensed here in Arizona to either be a part of an accredited institution if you're out of state, or they have to have a license here. So a lot of the online programs of this type are coming here, and some necessarily don't have physical presence because they're online, but BTR requires licensure, and that's their law. So I don't know if that sheds any light on these types of scenarios, which is kind of different since we have that opt-in statute or rule that they kicked in a couple of years ago. So that was all I wanted to say.
Thank you.
Yeah, I was just concerned about the $15,000 bond because of the huge deficit that they're showing on their financial statements. And I thought perhaps if they had separate financial statements just for the Arizona operation, we would get a better picture of what it is that we're licensing.
Mr. Ball, since you are going down that path, I agree with you. I am trying to really appreciate the financial stability of the company at this point, or the institution, from that, just based on what seems to be a significant loss within the last year of operation, possibly through investment, and just wondering how, if things don't turn around dramatically, how that is sustainable. Mr. LaMountain, you had something additional to add?
Mr. Romano, members of the board. Just as a reminder, so the institution does have a $15,000 surety bond. At this point in time in the renewal application, they had listed zero gross tuition revenue. So in terms of concern with the state, they did not have gross tuition, and they had no on their student. It looks like you placed two students, but you didn't have any, so I don't know how that works. But I do not believe that the institution had any students as well through the first year of operation. So just in terms of consideration for the bond.
I know sometimes filling out that information can be confusing as well. I felt as though I read it as you had two students go through the program, but to Mr. LaMountain's point, maybe they didn't go through the program. Can you share with us how many students actually did go through the program this last year?
So we had two within the last year and three to date. And I apologize for the mix up with that, the online form when plugging in that data. I swear I watched that instructional video probably a half a dozen times to try to get that correct. But to answer your question, I would say two within the past year.
And how many enrollments do you have currently for upcoming students?
I don't have that information right now, but I'd be happy to get that from our program manager and get that to you.
Sorry, Mr. Ball, I jumped in there. I'll turn it back over to you.
No, that's okay. I'll open it up to any questions by any other board members.
Mr. LaMountain, it looks like you have your hand back up.
Mr. Romano, Mr. Ball, to Mr. Wallstrom, if you did have two or three students, then the assumption is that the gross annual tuition, the gross tuition revenue, would not be zero unless you gave them free education. So that would be something that we would want updated. I understand the amount of your program, that number isn't going to change the application fee that you have applied to this. But it would be something important for us to note that you did have gross tuition.
Sure, and that if there were two students, it would be 1995 times two. And went to law school, not math school, so I can't do that off the top of my head. But that would be that number.
Mr. Wilson, can you help me understand? Obviously, if I'm understanding correctly, the company look to expand very quickly across 20 states, essentially. And those entities, or that is all controlled by Inspection Go. Those aren't franchisees across those locations. Is that correct?
That's right.
Okay. And so can you help me appreciate with the expansion and the activities taking place, how you landed on just two people going through the program?
Right. And I'm happy you asked that, just to give a little bit of background about that. We limited our selling focus in Arizona mainly because it required a big tweak to our curriculum, our usual traditional curriculum. Typically, with our 120-hour course, we would provide three ride-along field events. But in the state of Arizona, home inspectors need 30 parallel inspections, which not only is that a difference in quantity, but it's a little bit more time intensive and requires more participation on the part of the student to meet the regulations for home inspectors in Arizona. So what that ended up meaning for us is that we needed to take away that ride-along package from our usual 120-hour curriculum and create an additional package for students to purchase as a standalone parallel inspections package. So that, coupled with finding in-state home inspection company owners that would partner with us to provide these inspections, gave us, I guess, served as the reason why we didn't spend a lot of time selling or marketing in Arizona, but we wanted to make sure that we had our, we were compliant and had the appropriate license before we went to do so.
Thank you. And Mr. Lamont, just for clarity, and I apologize for asking such a naive question, but our focus is, because of how they're operating, is really only on Arizona students.
Excuse me, Mr. Romano, members of the board. I think the again, it goes back to a conversation that Mr. Blanchard had, which is this institution is eligible to apply under the state of Arizona because it's an opt-in. Normally, this particular institution, if they didn't have students if they were located someplace else, they wouldn't require licensure in the state of Arizona. But because they do need it for registrar contractors or board of technical registration, for that particular board, they need to be registered in Arizona, which then ultimately we the state of Arizona is responsible for the students that the institution is educating. However, for students that are in different states, fall under different regulatory challenges there, similar to a conversation we had not too long ago, which is I don't know where they're licensed and where they're not, and whether they need them or whether they don't. But in Arizona, they're the official word is that they're an Arizona licensed institution, and the responsibility is for. If we were to look at the responsibility under the Student Tuition Recovery Fund is only under students that are attending in Arizona, that are Arizona resident students, not students that are listed someplace else.
Okay.
But,
and so when you say you had two students, is that reflective of two students from Arizona versus across where you may have had students from other states that went through the program, or is it just really two in total?
Two in total for Arizona, but we had many, many states or many other students from other states where we were authorized.
Okay. And so obviously being unique in that, you know, and going back to what looks to be a significant operating loss, at least for three quarters of 2021, from the information that was provided to us, you know, obviously, it looks like the, as you're identifying it as academy revenue, just to understand, is that academy revenue generated by students going through this program, or is that other revenue outside of this particular course?
It would be revenue related to the what we draw in from our 120-hour course that's offered in totality.
Okay.
Any other questions?
All right. Just going just a little bit deeper, as I was trying to see when the company was actually established or the school was actually established. I'm a little unclear because I'm calling it company because it looks like there's other activities outside of the education of this that you're doing to generate revenue as actually providing services, possibly B2B or B2C, but not B2C to a student, but rather B2C to actually doing home inspections and charging for those. Is that an accurate statement, or is this a purely an educational institution?
I would say it everything you said is accurate until the very end. We aren't ourselves performing home inspections, but we have several services that cater to the home inspection profession. So not only are we providing the pre-licensing education and in some states continuing education courses, but management consulting for home inspection company owners, products and software that help make the profession a little bit easier. And then in addition to that, accounting, consulting services, HR services, just all for the home inspection, profession.
I see. Okay. And so when we're really looking at these financials, the financials encapsulate all of that. Is that a fair statement?
That's right.
Okay. And so getting back around, even though right now the educational part and the revenue associated with students is relatively small, the company as a whole did experience that very significant loss over the three quarters this past year. Sorry to be a dead horse. I'm just trying to validate that.
That's right. That's right. And I would say that there are a few factors, but off the top, citing the hiring of call center members, that was a significant payroll expense. But there are a number of factors that went into that. But as I said before, I think we're poised to reverse course, especially with the growth that we've had across the United States and getting authorized. And then also introducing a new version of the 120-hour course, which I believe I floated to Mr. LaMountain and Terry Stanfill, where it would be totally self-paced. It would be the same identical 120-hour curriculum. Just the Zoom courses would be pre-recorded class sessions, and this would be offered to students at a significantly lower price, and hopefully give us a better competitive advantage that we didn't have before.
I know you, and I'm not trying to get too into the weeds on your financials here, but I am just trying to again get an idea of sustainability. I feel like the call center, you're charging for it, if I'm reading this correctly, to a certain degree, for possibly services rendered. But then, obviously, one of the biggest costs, expenses on your financials is that of the employee payroll and benefits, which I'm assuming that call center is then making up that new addition of that amount.
That's right. And just to add to that, our executive team has spent a great deal of time within the last quarter and then this month also gathering funding and investment partners. And as far as I'm aware, we've landed a few. So hopefully that'll supplement our current situation.
Okay. I am not on our financial committee, nor do I want to be, Mr. LaMountain, just for clarity. are there any other questions, maybe, or suggestions from the finance committee group as guidance?
Yeah, this is Scott Wallace, and I am on one of those committee. And looking at your balance sheet, you got convertible debt, you've got another notes payable, and some other shareholder loans. Are those convertible to equity? Are they disguised equity? Because that puts you in a big deficit, and without that, it improves things a great deal. Is there any discussion in that regard of converting that into equity?
I could touch base with our accounting and finance group about that. I don't have that answer currently. But I would agree with you. I think that is a big contributing factor to the deficit that we have. But in terms of pinning down what we plan to do with that or its conversion to equity, I would have to I'd have to ping our accounting department on that.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
So Mr. Waller. Sorry, Mr. Ball. Go ahead.
I was going to say they did about, through September, they did a little over $3 million of revenue. So if they had two students at $19.95 each, that's about $4,000. So the Arizona operation is a minuscule, tiny little part of the company.
Yeah, without a doubt. Mr. Wallace, would in these sorts of situations, would it usually be the guidance from the finance committee to possibly, if a motion is made, to include some type of quarterly reporting or quarterly review or maybe a biannual review to come back towards the, or in front of the finance committee at least to possibly review financials?
Well, I think that would be advantageous and judicious. You know, whatever our guidelines are, permit us to do that. That I'm not real familiar with, but I would want to be monitoring the financial performance. You know, if they have two students here, you know, you might say that's pretty darn small, but I got to believe they want to have more than two students on a long-term basis or even an intermediate-term basis.
Would it warrant maybe a six-month review from now? Or would you suggest something on a quarterly basis for a review?
I would look at quarterly.
Just something to consider in the motion if that were appropriate or not. Mr. Lupke?
Yeah, I agree with Scott. A quarterly review would be advisable at this point.
Okay. Of internally prepared financials. Would that be something that's feasible, Mr. Wallstrom?
Yes, that'd be no problem.
Okay, starting with the quarter ending March 31 of 2022?
Yes, that'd be fine.
Okay.
Before we go to a motion, just one other piece of clarity. I did notice on the EA, there's actually no Arizona address on the EA, with exception to in the cancellation on page 3, where it just mentions that a cancellation would have to be sent to the Arizona. I'm not sure if that's required, Ms. LaMountain, that they do have the home state, I guess, or the state and where the headquarters is operating, but do we need to give guidance that EA would need to reflect the Arizona address?
Mr. Romano, members of the board, that's a that's an intriguing question that I don't have the answer to, as the institution doesn't have a true physical space in the state of Arizona. That's something that we'd have to get back to the board on, and specifically to the school, to the institution.
Okay.
But something that we will do.
Thank you. That was it for me.
Let me go back and ask a question that I think I answered I asked earlier. Is there any way to get financials just for Arizona?
I could gather that for you.
Would that be preferable to the board if we get just Arizona financials versus company-wide financials that show millions of dollars?
I guess I'd just push back on that, just to say, you know, I think it's been highlighted that the business section or the student outcome associated with Arizona is really, really small compared to that of the business as a whole. The business as a whole seems to be in financial stress at this point in time, may definitely work out of that. I guess I'm just curious if we ended up only looking at the Arizona students and them trying to carve out some percentage associated with the Arizona operating business, it may not protect the Arizona students from if something were to happen to the larger entity. So maybe it's a both instead of a one.
Okay.
And Mr. Romano and Mr. Ball, we also have Ms. Stedfield on the phone or on the meeting as well. They could add additional clarity, but what we have always asked for in financials would be at both levels, both the corporate, the big picture, because if that institution fails, obviously the school is going to fail as well. So I want to make sure that we're getting the big picture.
Ms. Stanfield, do you have your hand up? But you are still on mute.
Oops. I just wanted to reiterate what Kevin had said. We do, for the finance committee, we do almost always ask for the parent company financials. And then if we can get the financials for the Arizona campus, we will do that as well. I would just like to note, though, I understand you have a motion on the floor, but and they only have a few students, and again, as you've noted, it's a very small portion of the institution itself, and as well as we do have a bond, we would be able to monitor them and see if they have an increase in students at every renewal. At every renewal, we check enrollment data, and we do look at the financials. And we also ask for, if possible, information on the Arizona location.
Thank you, Ms. Stanfield. Ms. Stanfield, did you raise your hand again, or was that just you unraising your hand and then raising it? We have to love technology, right?
No.
All good. Any other questions from board members? With that, Mr. Ball, would you like to make a motion?
Okay. I'll make a motion that we approve the application for Inspection Go Academy to go from conditional to regular non-accredited vocational license with the stipulation that the $15,000 bond remain in place and that they provide quarterly financial statements starting with the quarter ending March 31, 2022 for both the parent or entity as a whole, as well as the Arizona operations, if possible.
And would that be to be reviewed at the finance committee?
And that would be, reviewed at the finance committee. So, Mr. Wallstrom, do you agree on maintaining the $15,000 bond?
Yes, sir. And just a question, just logistically, who would I submit the financial reports to?
Mr. Wallstrom, you would submit those to both myself and to Ms. Stanfield.
Got it. Thank you.
So we do have a motion on the floor. Do we have a second to the motion?
Scott Wallace will second it.
I also wanted to clarify, this is Assistant Attorney General Seamus Monahan. Did you also want the school to be present at those quarterly reviews?
Mr. Ball, that's your motion. Would you like to amend it to reflect that the school would at least be present?
I'll amend my motion to have the school be present at those finance committee meetings, yes.
Thank you.
Before we take a second on that, Ms. Stanfield, did you have something additional to add?
Yes, sorry about that. I just wanted to let Noah know that we send out an email right after the end of the quarter. I'm assuming you're a December fiscal year end.
That's right.
Okay, so you would get an email from us around the 1st of April that states and gives you a list of the reports that are needed, and that the due date is always 45 days after the quarter. And then you would be at the next meeting in June for the finance.
Understood.
Very good. All right. So Mr. Ball has provided a motion. Is there a second to that amended motion?
This is Scott Wallace. I'll second the amended motion.
Very good. Mr. Wallstrom, we know your agreements to that piece of it. Mr. Lamont, would you take roll?
Dr. Mittman? Dr. Mittman is absent. Dr. Leck?
Aye.
Dr. Leck votes aye. Mr. Romano?
Aye.
Mr. Romano votes aye. Mr. Lupke?
Aye.
Mr. Lupke votes aye. Mr. Ball?
Aye.
Mr. Ball votes aye. Mr. Wallace?
Aye.
Mr. Wallace votes aye. Ms. Cardullo?
Aye.
Ms. Cardullo votes aye. By your vote of 6 ayes, 1 absent, the motion passes.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Ms. Wallstrom, for coming out. We appreciate that. Congratulations on the movement forward. I know the Finance Committee looks forward to spending a little more time with you in the June timeframe, but we appreciate your attendance today as well. So thank you for that.
That sounds good. Thank you for having me. Thank you all for your time.
All right. So I know we've been at it for about 2.5 hours, and to be quite candid with everyone, I've been at it since about 6:30 this morning in the same seat, and I don't know if I can even feel my toes anymore. So I'd like to maybe take a break for 10 minutes, if possible, and maybe we could take a recess from now until 12:45 where we can reconvene. Okay, so with that, we will recess until at 12:35, and we will look to come back together at 12:45. Thank you very much.